See, what am I going to, what am I after in the exam? There's a whole lot of technical detail to these things. And frankly, I haven't gone into a huge amount of technical detail. Okay, I mean, one of the things you may have noticed is that I have said there are algorithms, there are polynomial time algorithms to deal with EL++. But I haven't told you what those algorithms are. So I can't ask you about that. So, what? And the reason for that is there isn't time. I mean, I think the algorithms are quite interesting and have. There's a lot of interesting challenges in this that are actually connected to other areas of computer science. But with four lectures to introduce me to the idea of description logics, tell you a bit about the notation, and then talk about what's there in the web technologies to deal with this. There just isn't time. So what can I expect you to be able to tell me? Well, what's it about? What is a description logic anyway? In what ways is it different from first-order logic? In what ways is it the same? Well, it's different. I mean, and it's, you know, one of the similarities is we're talking about formally defined languages with semantics. Okay, description logics and first-order logic have the same kind of semantics. It's all about, you know, sets and relationships. I can reasonably expect you to be able to tell me what goes in a T-box and what goes in an A-box. I can expect you to tell me what are some of the kinds of... I expect you to be able to remember... Look, I'm not going to be fussed about whether you use square intersection and union and all that, or whether you just use the round ones. Frankly, that's not actually important. But I can expect you to remember the idea of intersection and existential being a good combination. I can expect you to remember that negation, I mean, one of the basic things about propositional calculus, once you've got and not, you've got everything. So I can expect you to sort of guess that if you've got intersection and not, then you've got union. But what's the point? Why is there any interest at all in any sort of substandard logic, as it were? Well, why do we need it? And for me, I think this is the heart of it. We've got two different uses for logic. Logic in our heads and logic in our machines. We might want to express something in a language that has a formal semantics. And I'm actually going to touch on that in today's lecture. We might want to express something in a clear and unambiguous way. So we might be interested in using a logic for that. And we don't care if a computer can do anything with it other than checking the syntax or not. We might be able to prove something. I mean, people can prove things in second-order logic and higher-order logic. We can't prove everything, but we don't care about that. What we care about is, can we prove this thing? But the other use is for getting a computer to reason about huge amounts of data. Let's see if I can... Okay, I've actually got something I decided not to tell you, not to give you. It's a paper, SNOMED CT, The Global Perspective, by the Vice President / General Manager of the international organization that curates SNOMED. And he says, this is some years out of date now, it's bigger. 414,000 healthcare concepts 1,084,900 and some descriptions. 1.5 million semantic relationships. Editions in English, German, and Spanish. It's not just that they've got a type hierarchy, they've got 18 separate hierarchies. Things are related in 18 different hierarchies. Now, one of them's going to be type, one of them's going to be part whole. I don't yet know what the others are. Okay. Now, since that paper came out, it's gone from 400,000 to 600,000. Everything else has gone up even more. So we're talking about something where, realistically, no one human being is ever going to look at the whole thing. The only way human beings are going to get any information out of something that big is with machine assistance. So the point about description logics is we're interested in machine tractable logics. We're interested in things where we can say, from the information you've given me, I can derive this. And if what you told me was true, this is true. Okay. This is the fundamental thing that we want from some sort of reasoning scheme, whether it's a way for people to do it or a way for computers to do it. It should preserve truth. If you start from truth, you should end with truth. Now, if we start with weird axioms that says, let's say, every cat has gills, we can end up with some very weird consequences. But the rot's eaten right at the beginning. What we want is a way of reasoning that doesn't lead us into error. Now, it must be said from an AI point of view that actually we don't always want that. And this is where, if we had twice as much time, we could do a lot more interesting things. In the real world, sometimes you have to make decisions and you don't have perfect information to start with, and you can't expect to get perfect results. You've got to do the best you can. On Tuesday, my elder daughter, who is 18, told me that a friend of hers was planning to propose to his girlfriend of a year. They'd been together for a year. He was planning to propose to her. Yesterday, she told me he'd decided to break up with her. One of those decisions is unwise. I have no information that would let me tell which. The thing is, people have to make life decisions. Will I ask this girl to marry me? Will I show her the door? Without certainty. You go to the supermarket and you say, look, I'm hungry, I'm going to buy this apple. Maybe somebody came along and injected that apple with poison. Maybe it will kill you. This is not, sadly, a crazy suggestion. There was a big scare in the United States when I was there, I think it was, sometime in the 80s. There was a painkiller, popular painkiller called Tylenol. And some total... Sorry, this really deserves it. I'm sorry to swear, in mixed company. Some total asshole went around the country poisoning. He'd buy packets of Tylenol, he'd put poison in the capsules and put them back on the shelf. And quite a number of people got very sick and some died from poisoned Tylenol. So that's when we got that's why we've got tamper-resistant or tamper-evident packaging for a whole lot of things. So the next time it happens, people will know. But, you can never be sure. You can never be 100% certain that the next thing you buy out of a shop will not have been contaminated. Every year, there's a story about somebody gets a rat in a packet of frozen peas or a snail in the milk. That was a famous law case. What's even worse, half a rat. And unfortunately, so you never know for certain in the real world. So we need ways of practical reasoning that let us deal with probability. And we've got probability. We've got a beautifully worked out theory of probability. Unfortunately, for almost any practical situation, the calculations are totally infeasible for any human being. We need some sort of approximate probability reasoning to live. But we certainly don't want to go around deliberately introducing uncertainty and error when we don't have to. Now, SNOMED is about medicine. Now, in medicine, my elder daughter, she finally got a diagnosis last year that she had mild anxiety disorder and mild autism spectrum disorder. And, it had taken about 6 years to get that diagnosis. Telling what condition somebody has can be extremely hard. Okay. How come they hadn't picked up that she was slightly Asperger-ish? Because nobody tested it. So people had to be making decisions on what to do about her based on her behaviour, and nobody really quite knew what was going on. What's that got to do with logic? Okay, the diagnosis, whether somebody has a condition or not, is an empirical thing that's fraught with uncertainty. But if you've got a rule like if a deduction that says, anxiety disorder is not treatable with antibiotics, that's as certain as anything else we know. We don't have any reason to believe that anxiety disorder is treatable with antibiotics. There is a mental condition that is treatable with antibiotics due to a parasite called Toxoplasmosis gondii, but it's not an anxiety disorder. It's, if anything, the opposite. But, the thing about this is that the links between the concepts that we've designed, those are totally under our control. We know whether break in left forearm is a subclass of break in left arm because that's what we decided. So we can hope for sound reasoning from that. And there is a world of practical uncertainty, and there's a world where we're making definitions. And again, there is actually a connection here, because even in the world of practical uncertainty, if we've got definitions, we want to know what the consequences of our definitions are. We might be defining things wrong. And one of the things that happens with things like SNOMED CT, they are so large that they contain errors. And that's where today's lecture starts to come in. Okay, so actually, you may find that the most interesting slides in the whole of today's talk are at the end, when I name a program. Okay, so, and now I keep forgetting that I need to control the slides from over there, but talk over here. Okay. First of all, I want to say a little bit more about RDF. Now, naturally, we can say, are you familiar with the Wallace and Gromit movies? I love them. We can say Wallace eats Wensleydale. Okay, we're making an assertion there. But we can also say Gromit says Wallace eats Wensleydale. So here we've got a statement being asserted, and here we've got a statement being mentioned. We've got assertion, Gromit says this, and we're asserting that to be true. But Gromit says Wallace eats Wensleydale, and this one does not imply, this statement here, Gromit says Wallace eats Wensleydale, does not imply the first one. right, or you'd be wrong. So one of the things people want to do in AI and reasoning about people and what they do and so on, we want to be able to mention statements without asserting them. Okay, and by the way, this has a religious consequence. People will sometimes talk about contradictions in the Bible and, for example, in the book of Judges, there are two different accounts of how a guy called Sisera died. But they've taken it out of context because one of them is the narrator saying what happened. That's an assertion. And the other one is the narrator saying what another person said happened. So those two statements, Sisera died this way, Sisera died that way, they are contradictory, but the narrator wasn't contradicting himself. If I say Wallace eats Wensleydale, and the penguin, and if I also say the penguin says Wallace never eats Wensleydale, I've contradicted the penguin, but I haven't contradicted myself. So we do want to have this way of, here is a way of saying something, and here's a way of mentioning it, but not asserting it. And oddly enough, ARIA lets us do this. Okay. So here we go, this is what it looks like. Now I'm using the square monkey thing where there's a blank node, so I'm not naming the statement, but I could name the statement. So I'm saying, Gromit says something. That something is a statement, and this is a built-in type for that. That statement has Wallace as its, I keep putting these columns that don't belong. Sorry about that. I was doing some revision on these slides last night. Using Keynote. Unfortunately, I've got two copies of Keynote on my laptop, from iWorko 8 and from iWorko 9. I got the technicians to put iWorko 9 on my laptop. Unfortunately, when I came to save out the changes, the technicians gave me a demo version of iWorko 9 that won't let me save anything. So I had to race through copying all the changes from one to another. I didn't get anything fixed properly. So those columns shouldn't be there. There are supposed to be spaces here. It doesn't look like it. So the subject of the statement is Wallace, the predicate of the statement is Eats, and the object of the statement is Wensleydale. So here in these four, the node that I haven't named represents, is the statement as a resource. And these are the things that say what statement it is. So this lets us say, Gromit says a statement that Wallace eats Wensleydale. We can do that. But there's no way, there is no law, there's no semantic law about RDF that would let us say this entails that Wallace eats Wensleydale. And there's no inference procedure that will let us do that. Because, as I said, Gromit might be wrong or might be lying. So what is actually the point of this? Well, it's the fact that we might want to represent. Okay, now, one of the standard examples that people trot out is some sort of database about Shakespeare's plays. So we've got straightforward things like Shakespeare wrote the play Hamlet. The person Hamlet is a character in the play Hamlet. But then we might want to say Hamlet's father's ghost tells Hamlet that Hamlet's uncle killed his father. Of course, that's one of the important things about that play. Now, the fact that Hamlet's father's ghost says that's what happened doesn't imply that it is what happened, unless, like Hamlet, you believe Hamlet's father. Here's the thing. Suppose we wanted to talk about contracts. Contracts are about somebody. There is a contract that states this, but maybe it's not. Maybe that contract has been cancelled and it doesn't apply anymore. I've known somebody who was keeping information about Linux logical volumes in this sort of thing. Okay, and so logical volumes have certain properties, but they don't have them all the time. Something can be writable at one time and read-only at another time. So we might want to make statements about volume read-only true, but that might be valid at a particular time. And nothing stops us adding... Such vol 1 pred read only opt true we might want to say this is a statement that says volume 1 is read only. And we might want to attach to that something to see when that was true. So, it is actually quite useful being able to do this. And it's one of the more unusual features of RDF. It turns out when we think about this, there is something that's missing from Sparkle. Sparkle is sort of SQL-ish, but there's an important SQL concept that's missing from Sparkle. Now, we might have a belief about Gromit. We might believe that Gromit is never wrong. Whatever Gromit believes about Wallace is true, and Gromit's a pretty nice dog. We might believe he never tells lies. So we might want to have somewhere a rule like this. Now, by the way, this rule is not itself a description logic rule. Description logic lets us talk about properties of individuals, it lets us talk about class concept relationships, but it doesn't let us deduce new property facts. But we might want to have a logic layer above the description logic. We could say this. So it says, if Gromit says something that's about Wallace and relating him in some way to something else, then Wallace is in fact related in that way to the something else. We might want to have that as an inference rule in the next level up. And of course, Sparkle is in some ways precisely that next level up. So what could we do? We could define a view. We could say there's a view Wallace has relationship to object, and it's defined to be Wallace is directly asserted to have that relation to that object, plus whatever Gromit says Wallace is related to in that way. Now, this bit, everything after the equals, is expressible in Sparkle. So any particular query where we would like to use this thing, we can expand that out as a macro. But we have to do it before Sparkle sees it, because there is no way we can actually use bind to do something sort of like this inside a Sparkle query, but we have to write it out. We can't name that pattern and use it in several different queries. In SQL, we can define views. We could quite literally do this in SQL.
which is a pain. It would be nice to have a somewhat better language.
Now, one of the things about this, why is it important that Sparkle is fairly syntactically simple? We could have Sparkle as a target. We could define ourselves a richer language in which we had views. And we could translate that to Sparkle by a set macro expansion. But it's worth thinking about things like this. The more I think about this, the odder I find it. Okay, the web ontology language. And the is in scare quotes because there is no such thing as the web ontology language. Not really. There are three of them. However, there is a strict subset relationship between them. Owl Lite is strictly contained in Owl DL, which is strictly contained in Owl Full. And at this point, I have to admit to you that my personal knowledge of Owl is not fully up to date. This is Owl as it was, say, in about 2005, I'm talking about. Since then, there's been Owl 2, which came out about 5 years later, and is richer. So now, Owl 2 still has three layers. This one is called Owl EL, and it's called Owl EL because Owl 2's bottom layer is pretty much equivalent to EL++, which is why EL++ is so important. Owl DL, there's that they've got a rich, there's Owl QL and Owl RML, I can't remember which one is which. So they've lifted this one up a bit, they've pulled this one back a bit, and they've enriched that somewhat. But there are still the three layers. And why are there the three layers? It's all about the expressiveness-tractability trade-off. So if I asked an exam question, why are there three versions of Owl? The answer is, the more restrictions you adopt, the faster your inference procedures can go. Now, I'm not going to say much about Owl 4, and the reason I'm not going to say much about Owl 4, well, I've got two reasons, a practical one and a theoretical one. Owl 4 is simply not decidable. Owl4 is basically equivalent in power to first-order predicate calculus and then a bit. Now, Tim Berners-Lee had this vision of the semantic web. I touched on this before. The syntactic web is all about transporting around stuff for humans to read. The semantic web is all about transporting around stuff that computers can reason about. And there's an interview with him and in which he makes it clear that he knows that Owl4 is computationally intractable, but he doesn't care. He sees the job of Owl4 as being to provide something that is expressive enough for people's needs, and he's happy for people to try and work out additional subsets of it that might be tractable. So all of these have an official syntax in terms of RDF XML. There's a variety of syntaxes which can be translated into these, and particularly you can use Turtle to express all of these things. But RDF, it was originally designed for XML. So what we find in these things? What does Owl Lite do? It lets you define a very simple description. It's a very simple description logic. You can have a classification hierarchy. In fact, you can have several hierarchies. Just like I said with SNOMED, they've got 18 different kinds of hierarchy. The two obvious ones are ISA and PARTOF. You've got simple constraints where you can basically put types on predicates. You can say you've got the domain constraint and you've got the range constraint. So you can say this, if I say, you know, I can say about tens that the subject must be a person and the object must be a pet. And the key thing about this is the simplicity, and you get polynomial time algorithms for all the important things that you want to do with our polynomial time algorithms. It is richer than RDF. It is richer than RDF schema. And it's about as rich as you can go and still have polynomial time algorithms. I say about as because in L2, LEL goes just a little bit further, but it doesn't go any further than you can do polynomial time. So basically, if you can express something in L-Lite, that's the way to go. LDL, the DL stands for description logic, and it's trying to be more expressive. And they're trying to preserve completeness. Now, all three of these things, all levels of L, are concerned with soundness. An L engine, if it tells you I conclude that X should be forced to be true by the semantics of the inputs. But our light is complete. If it's true, it can be deduced. Our DL pushes as far as it can while keeping this business about completeness, saying if it's true, we can prove it. Excitability, the algorithm, it has to be doable in a finite amount of time. But of course, that might be many times the length of the life of the universe. So we're talking about things that have algorithms that are at least, that some of the algorithms are in P space. That's the things that can be done in, I had that list of complexities. P space is bad news. A reasonable amount of space and an unreasonable amount of time. But, you know, given enough time, it will hot. And the important thing here is, what we mean by calling LDL an extension of our light, any valid inference in our light is also valid in LDL. So if you take an our light database and you give it to an LDL program, you will not lose anything. Everything that could have been deduced will come out still, but it might take longer. Our full gives you full expressiveness, but nothing. You really can't expect that it will be complete. However, it's any valid inference in LDL is still valid in our full. Now, what's the connection with RDF? Well, it would be nice to say that all of these things are an extension of RDF, but it wouldn't be true. Our full does extend RDF, but LDL and LLite restricted. And the key thing is RDF, subject, predicate, object, type, all of that stuff, they're just strings. They're coded in a funny way, but they're just strings. RDF does not see any connection between foo colon bar as a subject and foo colon bar as a predicate. So you can use a resource as both an individual and a property. And of course, somewhere in the back of your head, there should be lurking the reason, why is there no such thing as a set of all sets in set theory? Well, the answer is that leads to paradoxes. So our DL and our light had this sort of type theory restriction behind them, saying an individual cannot be also a concept. So in particular, for example, we've got a type called class, but class is not an instance of class. And we don't have a class of all classes in our deal and our life. In our full, you can do that if you want to. So what you've got to do, you've got to declare every concept, RDF time, our class, every role should be an RDF property, every individual should be, you should declare every individual to belong to some type. And there is a maximal type that you can use called our thing. That's just true. So, I've got some slides about classes, I've got some slides about properties, and I've got some slides about individuals. So there is a class hierarchy. And by the way, the class hierarchy is not the same. Is a hierarchy. That doesn't mean that all hierarchies are about classes. Our nothing is empty. So that's our that's bottom. That's the bottom concept. This is the top concept. Our class is the type. Oh, you're spelling mistake. Type of classes, but of course not the class of classes. We've got a subclass of thing, and this is just the square subset thing. And we've got equivalence, which is just two of these, one each way. So you can state equality of classes. You can specify an intersection of classes, which is this. I'll spare you the syntax, it's not really interesting. It depends on a feature of RDF, which I haven't mentioned yet. RDF can let you represent collections. In particular, you can represent a list.
I don't want to go there.
There are properties.
And there's a type of properties. No, this is a type by class. There's a sub-property thing, so we've got a square subset-y thing. For properties, we've got the domain and range thing, that should be RDFS column range, I'm sorry. And we can say the two properties are equivalent, which is just two of those. That's pretty boring, actually.
Now, one thing we don't have in EL++ is inverse, the inverse of a role. Our light does have inverse of a role. And then it's got a bunch of things, assertions that you can make about properties. And if we were doing this in predicate calculus, this would be second-order predicate calculus. If we're saying that this property is a kind of transitive property, we're saying that this predicate is transitive. If x p y and y p z, then x p z. Now, the thing about this is, the restrictions on our light and our DL, we can't actually conclude that something is a transitive property unless we're told about it, basically. So this is really effectively a macro. Symmetric property, if x, p, y, then y, p, x. Now, RDF full, I think it's RDF full, has asymmetric property, where you say if x, p, y, then not y, p, x. It also has reflexive and irreflexive. But those things tend to include negation. The properties that we've got here don't include negation. Not exactly. We're heading up to something quite interesting. Functional property, we're saying if x, p, y, and x, p, z, then y and z are the same thing. For any x, there is at most one y, such that x, p, y. So we could say, father of is actually, and we've got it the other way around. Now, okay, I had on the board here, when you arrived and I started rubbing things off, I had part of a UML conceptual model. And I had piece, and I had location, and I had a one-to-one, I had a relationship between them, saying a piece is in at most one location. And a location includes, holds at most one piece. So, location of piece is a functional property. A piece can only be in one place, or it might not be anywhere. It's also an inverse functional property. A location might contain one piece, or it might not contain any piece. Now, what we've got here is a kind of number restriction. Remember where I said we could have things like less than or equal n. Okay. Something which is related to at most n
C's by R, and something which is related to at least N C's by R. I said, yeah, these were things we could have in a description logic, but that EL++ didn't have them. Well, our light has them with the restriction that N can only be 1. Or in fact 0, you can say that something's empty. So we can't do general N. We can't say Richard has at least one hand. So we can't say Richard has at least three pets. In fact, it's two now because one of our puppies died. But we can say I have at least one dog, and we can say I have at least one budgie. I could also have at most one dog and at most one budgie. But you can't say I've got at least two pairs. That's implied, but we can't say it. We can declare some restrictions. There's some special stuff here. So here's minimum, maximum, cardinality. These things in our light, the N has to be 0 equals 1, and in our DL, it can be more general, and we've got the for all restriction, we've got the existential restriction. Okay, individuals, what is there about individuals? We can say that individuals are members of classes, we should. We can say that two individuals are the same. We are allowed an inequality. It's a very limited form negation. We can say two individuals are different. We can say that all the individuals in a collection are different. We've got a list, so we can. Now, the only reason for having this, okay, if I want to say A, B, C, or different, this is equivalent to saying A not equal B, and A not equal to C, and B not equal to C, okay, and as the number of things goes up, and if you've got n things here, you've got order n squared inequalities. So this thing is really just an easy way to state a large number of inequalities. Now, our DL generalizes things. We can actually say, here is a class, and here are all of the elements of that class. We can say, the cost for 10 students in 2014 are these four people and no others. And we can also stick in an all different constraint to say, and by the way, no two of them are the same person. We can say classes don't overlap. Now, there's some horrible English here. In English, we can't say C1 is disjoint with C2. We have to say C1 is disjoint from C2. But in our, it's disjoint with. And our DL, I'm going to spare you the syntax here, it gets a bit complicated. The important thing is these things are expressible. We've got arbitrary Boolean combinations of classes. So it's quite a rich description logic. It's still a description logic. We can still have algorithms that process this. But as soon as you've got arbitrary Boolean combinations of classes, this has obviously got to be at least as hard as propositional logic. Because it contains propositional logic as a special case. So you can tell processing LDL has to be at least as hard as processing propositional logic because we've got arbitrary Boolean combinations of classes. Now, here's the practical reason why I'm going to ignore L4. There was a study in 2006, and they went out and they found an amazing number of ontologies on the web, 1,275. And they classified these things according to whether they satisfied the constraints of L-Lite or L-DL, or whether they required L-Full. And the majority of those things were in L-Full. They weren't in L-DL or L-Lite. But this was accidental.
most of these things, practically all of them, three quarters of so nearly all of these things, the people who'd constructed them intended them to be OWL light or OWL DL. They just left out bits. Typically, type facts for individuals that were necessary to show that things did actually satisfy the constraints. That's why I said it's important to put in all the type facts. So when they added those missing type facts, out of those 1,200 and some, there were just 61 left that weren't OWL light or OWL DL, and most of them were OWL light. Okay, so in practice, the things that people wanted to say overwhelmingly could be said in OWL light or OWL DL, and there's a warning here, which is that although OWL light and OWL DL are quite restricted, it's quite hard for people to make sure that their databases, their ontologies, do in fact conform to the restrictions. What can you do about that? Well, one, you can have better tools that just guarantee to produce things that way. Or you can provide some sort of debugging tool that will check and tell you, this is OWL full, but I think if you added these facts, it would be okay. Do you want me to do that? Okay. So it's already complicated enough that we need machine assistance to get it right. And it's not just that it's complicated, it's because of the scale that people are doing these things. So, how do you get to scale? Well, one way is by building on existing things. If somebody has, let's say somebody has a compendium of facts about chess, and somebody has a compendium of facts about drafts, and you want to put together a board game ontology, and you're happy to code up some facts about Lasker, which is sort of a variant of drafts invented by Chessmaster. University where I did my undergraduate degree in the computer science department there had some people who were very fond of playing Lasker. I never actually learned the rules. But, so what it's actually really handy to be able to say, well, here's my Lasker database. Now, here's this board games database that pulls in that guy's chess and that one's, that person's drafts and my Lasker. Okay. And, of course, this is the fact that you can do this is why we've got all of this messing around with URIs for naming things. So that these things can have... by the way, importing is not the same as textual inclusion. In my knowledge base, I can have prefix directives that assign certain meanings to certain prefixes. In that one, I can they could be different. When you import, these things are merged. What you get is the underlying triples, not the abbreviations. What prefixes was used is no longer visible. There's stuff there. Now, one of the things, if we're making big things, we can't get there in one big jump. We can go forwards. And they can be versioned. You can declare as a property of an ontology what is its version. You can say what was the previous version. And you can say what was the last version that this was compatible with. So if you've just added some facts, you can say I'm compatible with the previous version. If you then revise the way things are done, don't say this. So if somebody's inferred something using an old version of your thing and the new version is still backwards compatible with it, it's nice to know that you don't have to redo your calculations. Also, this is just a software engineering sort of thing for managing change to the database. You can decide, look, the way I was saying something was not a good way. I need to revise this. I need to say it a new way. But you're not yet ready to delete, to replace all the old stuff. So you can leave the old facts there, and you can switch over to new encoding, and you can say, look, don't use these in new stuff. And this, what's the effect of this? This has no effect on the semantics. The effect is on the pragmatics that a tool that's letting you work with an OWL ontology should stop you creating new facts that use deprecated classes or properties. Okay. So I mean, why am I mentioning this? There's also other annotations that you can add. There's actually nearly a dozen things that you can say that are metadata about the ontology. They're not about the individuals or the concepts. They're about the ontology itself. These are some of them. And they're there because the whole point of this is to have something that will let us deal with large volumes of facts. So large that we need to grow them over time and we need to revise them over time. Now, in the beginning, I said one of the important things about description logics is they don't make the closed world assumption and they don't make the unique name assumption. And this is definitely examinable material. You can pretty much guarantee that at some point there will be a question that says, what is the closed world assumption? Give me an example of an inference that it justifies that would not be justified without it. What is the unique name assumption? Give me an example of an inference that is valid when you can make that assumption and not valid when you can't. Okay, now that harks right back to the first of these four lectures. It's a very important thing. Now, as my reading of Sparkle, Sparkle lets you use NOT freely inside queries. And how can you ever conclude that X is not equal to Y in RDF unless you're making the closed world assumption, sorry, the unique name assumption, that if X and Y are different names, they must refer to different things. How can you ever say that Wallace does not eat Puha, let's say? Well, of course, he's never seen any puha, but if he had seen it, he probably wouldn't have eaten it. But how can we say that when there's nothing in the database that mentions Wallace and puha? And as far as I can see, the only way Sparkle can draw that conclusion, it's not the case that Wallace eats puha, except by making the closed world assumption by saying, if it was so, I would know it. But OWL is an honest-to-goodness description logic. OWL does not make the closed-world assumption, and it does not make the unique name assumption. And here's this oddity, then, that we've got RDF with a query language, and we've got OWL, which sort of extends RDF, and you can query an RDF, an OWL ontology, and these two things are not simply related. Sparkle can draw inferences that are simply not valid in OWL, and OWL can draw inferences that Sparkle can't compute. I had to mention Sparkle because Sparkle is used a lot. Okay, if people don't need the extra expressiveness of OWL, then Sparkle's not up to the job. But a lot of people are happy with Sparkle. It's familiar, it's SQL-like, and they're happy to make the unique name assumption and the closed world assumption for a closed ontology. They're happy to say, look, I've told you some facts about this. If you can't conclude it from those things, it isn't true. But here's an important thing. Given a particular set of logical statements, you cannot tell whether the closed world assumption applies by looking at those statements. Okay. Apply the closed world assumption is not itself directly statable in logic. Okay. It's a metalogical statement. It's at the next level up. So it's important documentation of this.
side issue. Okay. Now, this lecture is actually going to be pretty short because I don't have a lot to say. I just wanted to give you some idea where all this is going and why is it useful to know some of this stuff. Now, one of the things that happened when OWL was designed is they weren't quite sure whether it could be implemented, whether it would be practical to implement it. And one of the first demonstrations that OWL was actually practical was this program called Palette. Now, does either of you know what an OWL palette is? Well, it's like this. An owl will swoop down and catch a mouse, and it will eat it. And then, a little while later, it will go, and out comes the mouse's skin and bones in a nice little compressed sort of ball. And that's an owl palate. It comes from this end, not from that end, right? But it's linked with owls. It's web ontology language, that's wall, not owl. Why owl? Why did anybody want owl?
Everything owls. Is turtle as well?
Yes, that's true, but owls have a very special... in English we've got a saying that's like carrying coals to Newcastle, because Newcastle was a famous coal mining town. In Greece they had a saying, bringing owls to Athens. Owls were associated with the goddess Athena, who was the goddess of wisdom, amongst other things. So owls are associated with cleverness and reasoning. It's a cultural link there. So OWL is an open source program written in Java. It's a sound and complete reasoner for OWL DL. If you can, anything that is derivable from an OWL DL database, OWL the palette can deduce it, and it shouldn't make mistakes. Now, I don't actually know how many people were involved in it. I think it was about three people. It was 1.5 work years. So if there were three people, it's probably about half a year time. They said it took a few months. Now, the people who built palette started with no previous knowledge about description logic. They knew about logic. They knew a little bit about proving theorems and predicate calculus and propositional calculus, but they didn't have a deep knowledge of theorem proving. Now, again, if we had a paper that was twice as long, I could actually talk about some of the theorem proving techniques. I could talk about connection graphs. I could talk about resolution. I could talk about the Davis-Putnam algorithm. And I could talk about tableau methods. And they're basically using a tableau method, and you can go look that up if you're interested. But they knew nothing about description logics. All they knew about description logics was what they read in the OWL specification. And then, of course, they went away and did some extra reading and saw what people had been doing. So getting that done in half a year, that's actually pretty impressive. These must be good programmers. It's supposed to be good performance. There is a command line interface to it, there's a web interface to it, there's some sort of, you can link it into a program and drive it through an API. I've seen some benchmark figures. At the time that they wrote, there were several description logic inference engines out there written in C and C++. And Palette is definitely slower than them much of the time. But for some really hard problems, Palette was better. So there's a slowdown factor due to the fact that it's in Java, but there was a benefit because they actually had some better algorithms. So what can it do for you? It can check that an ontology is consistent. It can check... These are some of the things that we said in the first lecture. What can you do with one of these things? So you can say, well, I've said all this.
Does that make sense? Are there any errors in this? Have I contradicted myself? Concept satisfiability. Here is a concept. Could there be any instances of that? Have I constrained this particular concept so much that nothing can satisfy it? Classification is where you're given a whole bunch of things and say, well, can we sort this into a fairly complete sort of hierarchy? Realization, as they call it in their paper, you're given an individual to say, what can you say about that? Find me the most specific thing that you can say about a particular individual. Entailment, is this concept a subclass of that one? Because there's one more important thing that Pellet can do. Pellet is a program for LDL. Right? And I said there's a lot of stuff out there that's in LFull that was meant to be in LDL. And one of the big things Pellet can do for you is you can say, look, this is not LDL. But that's because you're missing some stuff. It says, maybe if you told me about the type of this and this and this and this and this, we'd be a bit closer to LDL. So it actually, this part and the restriction checking part make OWL a great debugging tool for LDL. So make Pellet a good debugging tool for LDL. So here's the bottom line. Okay. I've now told you the name of the program, and you can go out there and you can find it. And you can use it. There are others. Oracle have a program. I've forgotten it. Oracle Prime, I think it's called, that does this kind of stuff. I don't know what they charge for that. There's a whole bunch of these programs out there. So if you have some information which can be expressed in LDL, you can use this one of these existing things as a building block to help you grow and maintain a knowledge base and to extract information from it. And you know, what's the point about being able to have an API to it in a program? You can combine it with other things. Now, OWL itself, I should ask you a question here. What can you tell me about Gödel's incompleteness theorem? Willem hasn't mentioned it. Oh my. Huh. Okay. You really ought to look this up. There will not be any same question on it, at least not from me. Any logic I'm going to express this in a way which I find illuminating. It's not the standard way to express this. The usual way of saying it is that any logic which is expressive enough to include natural number arithmetic, okay, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, add, subtract, multiply, test for divisibility, that kind of thing. Any logic which is expressive enough to include that contains unprovable true statements. But it's basically really, it's a simple counting thing. There are things that are true because the semantics compel them to be true. There's an important difference between being true and being provable. Okay. A provable statement is one which you can reach by taking a finite set of starting facts and applying inference rules, a finite number of times, it ends up with this fact at the tip of the tree. So a proof is basically a tree or possibly a directed acyclic graph. Proof is is one of these things such that every node in the tree represents the sound application of an inference rule to some other facts. Now, when it's presented in the usual fashion, this seems incredibly deep and meaningful. But it's very simple that there are a countable number of proofs. Proofs are made by combining a finite number of facts using a finite number of operators. Any proof can be encoded as a natural number. There are no more proofs than there are counting numbers. Because we have to be able to write, and it's really, really crude and simple, because in order to be any use, we have to be able to write a proof down in some finite discrete alphabet. By the way, it's already the case that there are computers generating proofs of useful things where the proofs contain thousands of steps and no human being can read them. I mean, we can read each step, but we can't understand the whole thing. But the simple fact that proofs have to be writable down, which means there's only a countable number of them, whereas there can be uncountable numbers of true things. The reason that Gödel's incompleteness theorem came as a big shock, the very famous German mathematician David Hilbert had, towards the end of his career, posed a set of problems that he wanted to see 20th century mathematics solve. And one of them was the mechanization of mathematics. He wanted people to be able to say, okay, here's a claim about some mathematical theory, put it in, turn the crank, out comes an answer, it's true, it's false, or it's sometimes true, sometimes false, whatever. And in Gödel's incompleteness theorem proved it can't be done. In any theory that's interesting enough, there are going to be too many true things for us to prove. And it doesn't have any effect on, I mean, God himself cannot, I mean, God might have good reason to know that some fact is true, but he couldn't produce a proof of it because there simply is no finite string from a finite alphabet that can do it. Okay, presumably God is clever enough to reason infinitely, but we're not. So because we're finite beings, we're asking for finite proofs. Okay, there just aren't enough of them to go around. And that's one of the reasons why completeness is a tricky question in any logic. The thing about this is, if we're using a description logic, it can be quite rich in what it can say about classes and is there and part of and transitivity and all that kind of stuff, but it's going to be totally unable to express the concept that 7 is prime. What happens if we want to combine a description logic with something else? Now, this topic has come up over and over again in the automation of logic. It came up in program verification. One of the ideas people came up with was to say, look, instead of having one uber logic that does everything, can we sort of factor this out? Can we combine several theories, each of which is fairly weak and limited in what it can say, and can we put these things together in such a way that a reasoning program can say, oh, look, that's about arithmetic, I'll give it to the arithmetic module, or this is about ordering, I'll give it to the ordering module, or this is about groups, and I'll give it to the group module, or whatever. And that's actually one of the standard techniques these days in building program verification tools, is combining theories. Now, there is a technique that Palette is designed to work with, which maintains a rather stronger separation with theories, but between the theories. But anyway, Palette is designed to be worked in that way, where you've got a system that contains several kinds of theory, and one of them is these hierarchies and parthole and nizer stuff, and one of them is maybe something about numbers, and you don't have arbitrary combinations of these things, but then but modular statements can be expressed and proved. Okay, so Palette is actually intended to be one building block in a richer system like that, that can let you have limited arithmetic with limited logic. So we're still trying to be polynomial time and all that, but it's not trying to do absolutely everything in the one logic. Just to give you a taste about this complexity stuff, In Pressburger arithmetic, you're limited to equality and inequality statements between expressions that are linear combinations of integer variables with integer coefficients. So your arithmetic expression language adds, subtracts, and multiplication by known constants. And why multiplication by known constants is allowed? It's because it's equivalent to repeated addition. So really, all we've got is add and subtract. So any formula like this is equivalent to it all reduces to something like this. We've got a sum of some number of variables, we've got another sum of some number of variables, possibly repeated. We subtract them, and we say that this is greater than or equal to zero. So it's a very limited form of arithmetic, but that's about as far as we can go efficiently. I should mention something. Program verification, and not just program verification, program optimization, compilers would often like to prove things about these subscripts are always in range. Now, the reasoning about those, you've got conjunctions of inequalities and things which turn out to define multidimensional polyhedra. And there's a library which is used by a number of programs, including, I believe, the current version of GCC, but I'm not sure, called the Palmer Polyhedra Library, that lets you reason about things that are not entirely unlike that. So there are programs out there that can do quite impressive amounts of reasoning about programs and things that occur in programs, subject to the fact that if it's complicated enough, once you start talking about arbitrary multiplication and division, Gödel did it by managing to prove that you could encode any proof as a number. So you could if you could prove anything, then you'd find things where you could say, you could prove a formula that says it's not provable, which would be a paradox. So anyway, it's all about tractability. There's stuff out there that you can use. You might want to be interested in poking around in the material from last year where I talked about constraint satisfaction problems and pointed people to a particular Java program that's a library that can let you solve these things quite handily. I have used it myself for an industrial application where unfortunately I ended up not getting paid. I'm still annoyed about that. But so it's a good news, bad news thing. The good news is there are lots of programs out there that can let you, that automate large chunks of reasoning in useful ways that you can actually just get quite freely for nothing and use as a building block in something else. That's the good news. The bad news is there are fairly serious limitations on what they can do, because otherwise it gets too complicated. And that's really all I have to say. So this is a short lecture. I'm sure